ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elodie Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Adesk, to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It's Monday, June 12th, 2017. I'd like to make an announcement today. I'm retiring. No, I'm just kidding. Don't get serious. I don't want to get a whole bunch of phone calls. Greg Hunter will be joining us tomorrow. We confirmed it with his office. He will be joining us for pretty much the hour tomorrow, Tuesday, June 13th. So make sure you tune in tomorrow, and we'll have a little bit of a reminder later on the program for those who join the program at a later time. We did continue to have a sell-off. Oh, good afternoon, Al.
Hi, Marty.
We did have a sell-off again today. It extended its loss a second day from Friday in technology stocks, led by losses in Apple. Oil prices rose on signs of inventory declines in the U.S. And so the technology sector continues to drag down all three major stock indexes. There were some rebounds in the European, the pro-European parties. I guess they're with the French elections over, and I guess that Macron is really, you know, doing some things over there in France. The Italian elections over the weekend. I also saw that Spain is, I think next month, is going to have some sort of an election going on. Both the euro and its bonds rallied. After all, a lot of the jitters over there kind of went away. The jitters that we have here in the States, you can blame, you know, the Federal Reserve's policy meeting this week. Pretty much everyone is, you know, they're going to do a quarter point. And I think everyone is expecting the fall to be a little volatile, to say the least. So I don't think the September increase will be there. And who knows if there will be another one in December, depending on what goes on this fall. So there's been lots of warnings. Ray Dalio, he sent out a letter to his investors on Friday warning them that for the first time since just before World War II, there is a great economic, social, and political polarity that has given rise to, you know, he's talking about the populist leaders. But he's also talking that this also brings a lot of volatility to the markets. So take it for what you will. So we had a little bit of pressure on gold today. $1,266 for gold, $1,266 today, down 130. Silver was down 24 cents today at 17.03. Platinum was up $3 at 945, and palladium continues to rise, 902. That's an incredible price for palladium. If you have palladium, I'd be trading, selling or trading. It was up $11 today at 902. The USDX today was down 0.11 at 97.17, and we have crude oil up 0.21 at 46.04. The paper markets today, let me bring them back up. You had a little bit of pressure. The Dow, I mean, this was all day. It was just the Dow was down 36 points, 21,235. The NASDAQ was down 32, 61.75. The S&P was down 2 at 24.29. 10-year yield, 2.21%. It was up 0.01. The euro, 1.12. That was up a little bit. European markets were all down. Hong Kong was down 1.25%. Most of those markets, when I got up early morning, they were down significantly. Germany was down over 100 points. They were all down. Hong Kong was down more than their 318 points, and they did rally back to some degree. Japan was down over 100 points. So they did rally back, and it's pretty much what we saw in our markets today, although our markets weren't hit as hard as some of those foreign markets. So I believe we are beginning to see this volatility creep back, you know, into these markets, Al. And you know, we talk about the bond market. These bond yields, until recently, you know, when they took the rate, last rate increase, you had the 10-year yield at 2.60. After the rate increase, that dropped just recently. We've been seeing it come back little point by little point, but not much at all. And there's a lot of calls out there due to these, you know, that you know, this bond market, this $14 trillion U.S. Treasury market, you know, they're waiting. They talk about the Treasuries becoming unhinged from reality.
They already are.
And yields have nowhere to go but up, but yet you see investors who aren't even remotely concerned about the possibility of a sell-off. It's just not sustainable. There's calls. This gentleman, the chief global strategist at Deutsche Bank U.S. Security Unit, he's calling for the 10-year note treasury to be 3.25% by year end. Bill Gross, we talk about him regular, who runs the $2 billion Janus Henderson Global Unconstrained Bond Fund. He used to work for PIMCO. He was called the Bond King. He says, and I think we talked about this last Wednesday, he's saying U.S. financial markets are at the highest risk levels since before the 2008 financial crisis. You know, so again, these yields are going to climb. And, you know, the bond market is going to come undone.
And what you're saying when you say the yield is going to climb, you mean that the price of bonds is going to fall, and
correct.
Then when, in theory, when they are redeemed, they will make more money back, but the actual price, if you buy it today, will go down.
Yeah, the value of the bonds going down, the yield's going higher. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember all year, and it's you have to remember that the 10-year yield, that is based on, you know, a huge amount. All your home mortgages, everything is based on that. So as that rises, so does the cost of everything else for loans. So you're going to see people slamming on the brakes. The mortgages aren't going to be, homes aren't going to be bought. People aren't going to be able to afford car loans. They're not going to be able to, their credit card debt increases significantly. So they're not going to be able to either get new credit or you're not going to be able to, you know, pay what you have. And Americans have suddenly stopped paying off their credit card bills since we're talking about it. In the last two fiscal quarters, banks have reported a steep rise in credit card charge-offs. Debt that companies can't collect from their customers. This is according to Moody's. This is the largest increase since 2009. And everybody talks about how strong the U.S. economy is, how strong the U.S. employment markets are. And it suggests that American consumers maybe haven't fallen onto hard times so much as banks have started to loosen their standards and issue credit more aggressively. And we've talked about the subprime credit on these auto loans and so forth, on these house mortgages, where Wells Fargo came up with a loan, a mortgage loan, where, you know, your credit score was, your FICO score had to be 650. So is this what's coming into the market, or are we continually told that how strong is the employment market? Well, we're on the consensus that it's not that strong.
According to some sources, there's 95 million Americans who are of working age who don't have jobs.
Yeah.
All right, and they say we only have 5% unemployment. Well, yeah, okay, or actually 4-point-whatever unemployment, but less than 5%, and yet there's 95 million Americans who could be working in theory but don't have jobs. But we don't count them as unemployment. Well, they gave up or who knows what. Maybe they inherited money when Aunt Marge died or something. Hard to say. But the truth is that they found another way to live. I mean, you can't just sit back and say, well, you can't just sit back and say, well, I'm not going to work anymore. Okay, what are you going to do for groceries? What are you going to do for rent? They found a way to get by without actually working in regular jobs, but they've got something else going on. And maybe they're on welfare, maybe they're on government subsidies, but I don't believe that. I don't believe that accounts for 95 million people.
Well, no,
they
found
a way to get
also,
by, but they're in a, I don't know.
I mean, that number includes retirees. It includes a lot of people. What the problem is the wages that they're being paid. There's nowhere in this country, I don't know where this report came from, I don't know if it was Bloomberg, there is nowhere in this country where someone working a full-time minimum wage job can afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment. And this is according to a report that was released on Thursday by the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Nowhere in this country, if you're working a full-time minimum wage job, can you afford a two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
Downsizing to a one-bedroom will only get you so far a minimum wage. Such housing is affordable in only 12 counties located in Arizona, Oregon, and Washington states. So you have three states and there's 12 counties that you can afford a one-bedroom apartment on minimum wage. You would have to earn $17.14 an hour on average to be able to afford a modest one-bedroom apartment in a safe area without having to spend more than 30% of your income on housing. Make that $21.21 for a two-bedroom home, nearly three times the federal minimum wage of $7.25. So the wages are, you know, I don't care how many jobs you bring back into this country, the jobs aren't going to, the jobs won't supply the wages.
Well, they don't need to as long as we keep bringing immigrants into this country, especially illegal immigrants who are willing to work for less. I mean, we've said it for years. As you bring the illegals in here, they reduce the wage scale.
But you know what? That the damage on that has been done. The corporations in this country anymore, it doesn't matter if the illegal aliens are here or not. They've got people who just want to work. They can pay them anything they want anymore. The economy stinks. Prices are rising. All your need cares are going higher. Your food, your housing, your health care, all of those things are rising, you know, to the moon. So people can't afford this stuff. So, and these corporations, yeah, you're right. The immigration.
It's one factor.
Drop those. But now, I don't think that, you know, that, I don't think that matters anymore because they've got.
We've been conditioned.
They've been conditioned.
We will now accept. Look, look, I've got a minimum wage job. Yay! I don't know what to say. It's just more evidence that the world is, you know, an increasingly confusing, bewildering, and risky place. And I think everyone appreciates this to some degree. There are more people who are apprehensive about whether they're going to be able to hold on to their jobs, even though they're employed. There's more concern, according to some reports, that they might be laid off. About a third of workers are concerned they're going to lose their jobs. I don't know anyone who can look at the financial system in this country and say, great, things are going to be, things are just getting better and better and better. I don't think that's true. And as we talked last Friday, there are a host of individuals on Wall Street, former government employees, whatever, talking heads. But there is great agreement that we are on the edge of a significant problem, right? Some sort of a decline, a crash, recession, depression, something. And there is surprising consensus on the idea that we're going to have that problem in the near future. And I don't see maybe one report from, you know, some obscure individual or whatever that things are going to get better, but mostly everybody's warning, you know, better buckle up, folks. There's trouble right around the corner. Now, that doesn't mean it's true. I'm just saying there is a consensus among the talking heads that good times are not upon us.
No, you have an apparel giant store, Ascena Retail Group. They operate brands like Ann Taylor, Lane Bryant, The Dress Barn. They're planning on closing hundreds of stores.
Yeah.
That means hundreds of jobs. That came on the heels.
Thousands
of jobs. The news came on heels of a brutal quarter. The company reported a net loss of $1.031 billion. ending April 29th. Net sales fell to $1.5 billion, down from $1.6 billion in the year ago period. Total same-store sales fell 8% amid a decline in store traffic across all brands. Ascena currently operates over 4,800 stores throughout the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico. On the chain's earnings call, President and CEO David Jaffe said the company will close more than 250 locations by next month. And an additional 400 stores could close if the company can't negotiate reduced rent with the landlords. Over the next 2 years, they expect to close or achieve substantial rent reductions in more than 650 stores, which represent almost 25% of the total population with lease term maturity between 07 or 2017 and 2019. That's if they can't renegotiate. So if they can't, all those stores will be closed. Ford is offering buyouts to 15,000 salaried workers in the hopes that 1,400 of them will accept the offer. Well, if I was the other thousands of salaried employees, I think I'd take their offer because it'll just be a matter of time until we go without being offered a buyout.
Yeah.
You know, so, and this is going to start immediately. So
well,
you
tell me
where things...
What are these people going to do with them buyout money? I mean, how much are they going to get? And we are at a time. Okay, you make a nice little stack of dollars to walk away from your job and maybe even your pension. Right? What are you going to do with it? Because I doubt that it's going to be enough to carry you for a number of years into the future. I didn't carry. It'll probably work for a couple of years, but sooner or later, you're going to need a job. And it's one of the things where if you all of a sudden come into this money but you don't have a job, you either have to start a business or you have to make some serious investments, and you have to make some smart investments that are going to continue to generate some sort of income during the years when you are not employed.
Yeah, but Al, these jobs are going to be axed anyway. So you either accept the buyout and get a nice buyout, so you walk away, and yeah, you usually walk away with a reduction or something in your pension or so forth. But they want to trim costs by $3 billion a year. And these are salaried workers. These aren't the assembly line people. These are people who make good livings. And this is the first buyout offer at Ford since 2009. Okay,
what's that
so we're
do
back
to the price
to
of real estate? What's that going to do to the price of real estate, Melody?
I don't know.
Well, these people, if they're making good wages, they're living in good houses. What are they going to do when they can't live
make
there
the
anymore?
Payment anymore.
All right, the prices of those homes are going to fall. We're going to take a break, a couple of commercials. Be back in a moment on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
We will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule the world.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188, for all your gold and silver coin needs.
Yes, and I'm going to continue. Great buy for the 90% silver quarters. They're beautiful quarters. They're circulated, but they're still very nice. $350 includes your shipping costs. For $25 face value of 90% silver. So you can buy one little package, two little packages. Reminds me of a song, Al. I can't. 10 little Indian. I don't know. Anyway, you can get all kinds of packages. One or 100 of these packages. So it is a great buy. And 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188.
Do you get a copy of 10 Little Indians? If you
10 buy, Little Indians.
Uh-huh. If you buy 10 one packages, do you get 10 Little Indians to go along with?
What is that song? One little nursery rhyme, one little Indian, two little Indian. I don't know. Anyway, 90% silver. Give us a call. Make sure you sign up on our news on our website, dgscoins.com. That's dgscoins.com for our weekly newsletter. You just hit the little mailbox, fill in the blanks, and receive your the issue goes out on Mondays, sometime in the afternoon. So one is due, so make sure you get there and sign up. And remember, folks, if you have any questions, we encourage you. We want your involvement. You can send me an email at discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com for any questions, comments, if you'd like to have them read on the air, or you can call us on whatever topic that we might be discussing, 844-769-2944. That's 844-769-2944.
An article here from CNBC talks about renting versus buying a home. And their headline is, don't put your money in a house. You should rent instead. That's the gist of the article. And they're saying, essentially, one of the outfits, Florida Atlantic University, is calculating an index on whether it's better to buy or to rent home. And it factors in home prices, rents, mortgage rates, and alternative investments that create wealth. Essentially, it calculates the wealth accumulated when owning a home compared with the wealth accumulated when renting the same property and investing the down payment somewhere else. So what they're arguing is that in a lot of markets right now, in a growing number of markets, rather than buying a home that's of, you know, particular cost you a certain amount on the mortgage and whatever, buy instead of renting a home that's worth $300,000. You're better off to rent a home that's worth $300,000 and save the down payment that you would have spent to buy the home and use that down payment to invest elsewhere. What do you think about that, Melody? Do you think the average person can make an investment, conventional investment, that's likely to be better off to have that investment plus a rented home as compared to no investment, and buying the home, which one do you think is better?
I think it depends on what's suitable for the person. I don't think anyone always fits into these little categories. You know, not for everyone is renting better. Buying is not good for everyone. So you really do have to, you know, see what's suitable for you when you're making those determines. Yes, I do agree. The rising house home prices, we're going to see increased mortgage rates. And again, we go back to the incomes, the wages. They're not rising in the same manner that these prices are. So people aren't going to, they're unable to afford the purchasing of a home.
This is for people who, this article I'm reading from is for people who actually could afford to buy the home. But they're saying maybe not. Maybe you're better off to rent a comparable home and use investor down payment in something else where you can make money off that investment.
Well,
and it makes a certain amount of sense to me from this perspective. Homes are at or near record high prices. And that tells you that the end is near. It implies that if you buy a house right now for, say, $350,000 in anticipation that it's going to go to $400,000, it may be more likely to go to $300,000 than $400,000. We are at the peak. Maybe it's a bad time to be buying homes. Maybe
well,
it's just
I
a good
never,
time to be renting.
I never buy a home for an investment. So that's the key. If you're going to buy a home and you're going to live in it, you have to buy one that you can afford. I mean, yeah, it's homes depreciate with everything that you put into a home in the long run. Do you, you know, unless you buy a $30,000 home and over the years it went to $1 million, you know, in some of those California homes. But people really shouldn't buy a home as an investment and expect it to always go up, because it doesn't. It does come down.
I mean, it's not like Bitcoin, which goes up forever.
Yeah. Yeah. So, You know, this is coming from CNBC, and I think what this article is telling you, that prices, that rising home prices, yeah, they're at a peak. How much higher can they go based on this economy? And they want you to put that down payment back into the stock market. You know, so...
I say they just say investments, but how many investments are credible in this arena? I mean, I can understand, you know, I understand, okay, don't put your money into a house. I get that. That's not true in all cases and in all places. But I get that. I understand that. But where do you put your money? Historically, that house was a place where the ordinary home buyer, that was where he thought he was going to make his money. He was going to see it appreciate and appreciate and appreciate, at least up until 2007, 2008. You know, they buy a second home, they would appreciate even faster.
Just like anything else, there's cycles. You know, you have good mortgage, good real estate times and so forth. But I would never buy a home for, you know, if I buy a home for an investment, it would be rentals or something like that. But as far as the home that I live in, I'm not going to bet my money that it's going to be an investment and it's going to go up. I don't think it's...
Even though it may not be going up, you still have to look at it pretty closely to make sure you wind up saddled with something for the next 20 yeah. years that you can't afford.
Exactly.
What if it goes down?
Exactly.
I mean, is it still... should people be all right? The price of the home, you're now underwater, but just the same. You know, you're getting the house for a certain price. Can we still afford if the house is worth less than the mortgage payments that are still due? Should they hang on to the house or... My point is, there are investment implications in buying a home. Even though you may not buy it as an investment, it still is kind of an investment that could go the wrong way for you. Might not go up, it could go down. Is that something people should think about, or just say, okay, I can afford this, let's move in?
Well, I mean, everybody has to make a wise investment decision when they're purchasing a home. I mean, sometimes things happen in our lives that are just, you know, it's beyond our control. You know, stuff happens. You know, but, you know, you don't want to be foolish or anything like that. Personally, I believe real estate right now is too high. But we all need a roof over our head. So if you're looking to purchase, if you're looking to buy a home, I'd wait. Because I think the prices will come down.
I think they have to.
I don't believe it's really that the prices are overvalued. It's going to happen because the mortgage rates are going to be rising and people aren't going to be able to afford the higher rates. And people say, rates used to be, you know, 5-8%. It was no big deal. We had strong economies before and so forth. Well, yeah, but you know what? We had better wages too. You know, we weren't in the predicament that we are now.
What years are you talking about, Melody, when the mortgages were 5-8% and it wasn't a problem?
End of the late 90s, early 2000s, at 401.
I would have thought it was back earlier than that, but I was looking to see.
Because in 89, I mean, there was some rate, you know, in the 80s, I mean, rates were high, you know, and they started coming down. But so I would say, you know, because we bought homes in the late 90s and prior to 9/11. And I can remember talking to the mortgage company and we were paying about 6%. And I remember talking to them and saying, well, you know what? These rates, the interest rates are, you know, for the Federal Reserve are going to go to zero. And he says, well, if it goes to zero, that means I'm out of business. And I'll never forget him saying that. He thought I was a nut. Mm-hmm. And here I'm telling him, no, rates are going to go down. And so I don't know the exact year, but it was the late 90s prior to 9/11 and early 2000 prior to 9/11. And then after 9/11, of course, they needed to, you know, stem the, you know, the economy. So then you saw, you know, rates drop a little bit, and, you know, up and through to where we are today. But
I think part of the reason, you know, I've been advancing the idea for a couple issues for the last 6 weeks or so, maybe eight. But the government, because we live in a debt-based monetary system, it doesn't merely allow us to go deeper into debt. I think we're required to go deeper into debt. I think we have to go deeper into debt, and I can't prove it, but I think it may be true that we have to go deeper into debt in order to fund that debt-based monetary system. And if that were true, it would be consistent with the government, Federal Reserve's persistent lowering of interest rates, which has been going on for a considerable period of time. It hasn't just happened since 2007, 2008. We've had a slow lowering of interest rates to encourage people supposedly to go buy homes, but I wonder, are they being encouraged to buy more homes, or are they encouraged to create more debt? Will lock knock the interest rate down so low, you're crazy not to create more debt. You're crazy not to borrow more money. If you catch my drift, though, it's not to stimulate this. Oh, this is to stimulate the economy. But not in the sense that most people would think about it. So we're going to drop interest rates so people can buy homes, so we can put people to work building homes. All right? That's the way we think about this. That's the way we're inclined to think about it. But maybe the real motive behind dropping interest rates down to near zero, and in some places in the world, negative interest rates, maybe it's just to create more debt instruments to fuel this debt-based monetary system. I'm not saying that's God's truth, but I suspect it might be, or at least close. You know? So we have a world that is just running on debt, 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 and more debt, and there has to be an end to it. It cannot continue. And your guess as to when it ends is as good as mine, but nevertheless, it is inevitable that it's going to go down. It's going to end. And what do you do? Well, to my mind, you start saving. Instead of going deeper into debt, start going deeper into savings, and then saving in something tangible, in something that's going to hold its value even if there's a difficult situation, a serious bump in the economic road. You're looking for something like gold, like silver, that will hold its value. Right? If this thing goes south, if this debt system breaks down, and it seems to me inevitable that it must. It's inherently crazy.
It's not a matter
crazy.
Of if.
Yeah, it's a question of when. That's all.
It's not a matter.
This is going to happen. So if you're sensible, this is a little like talking about homes. Don't buy the home. Invest the down payment somewhere else. Not a bad idea necessarily to invest that down payment if you agree with the argument.
I wouldn't put it in paper.
I understand. I understand. Right? You're going to look for something tangible. You're going to look for an alternative investment, gold or silver.
I get calls all the time of people who call me and they say, well, you know, my house is paid off. Should I take a mortgage out to buy gold and so forth? You really shouldn't go into debt to buy gold. I have many, many, many clients who have done that. But yet, on the other hand, the key thing that you have to ask yourself whenever you're going into any investment is that you're going into debt for is what's the worst case scenario? At least with gold, you have something to sell back. You know, if something happens that you don't have the payment to pay off, or you know, something happens to your income, you got the item to sell.
Back by the name of Business Insider has an article that parallels what you're talking about. A self-made billionaire says most people make the same mistake evaluating risk in business. He said, if you ask billionaire Sam Zell, the basics of business are straightforward. It's largely about risk. If you've got a big downside where you could lose a lot of money and a small upside where you could make some money, run the other way. Don't invest. If you've got a big upside and a small downside, do the deal. Always make sure you're getting paid for the risk you take and never risk you cannot afford to lose. Keep it simple. A scenario that takes four steps instead of one means there are three additional opportunities to fail. Zell calls risk the ultimate differentiator. I've always had a deep and complex relationship with risk, he writes. I am not a reckless person, but taking risks is really the only way to consistently achieve above average returns in life as well as in investments. However, I am probably more comfortable with risk than most people. That's because I do as much as I can to understand it. To me, risk-taking rests on the ability to see all the variables and then identify the ones that will make you or break you. He says, after decades of running companies and evaluating risks, he found that many people make the same mistake. They're too focused on what happens if everything goes right. All right? This is like, right now, Bitcoin. They can invest in Bitcoin because so-and-so just said it's going to $1 million a coin, Melody. Okay, that's if everything goes right. And Zell is saying, you got to actually start thinking, what if it goes south? What if it goes bad? He says, everybody wants to look at how good a deal can get. People love focusing on the upside. That's a function of their greed. That's where the fun is. What amazes me is how superficially they consider the downside. That's the fear side of the equation. And what he's implying here is to be a good investor, we are motivated by fear. We are motivated by greed. You've got to be motivated by both of them when you make an investment. And you've got to balance them. You can't just be motivated by fear. You can't just be motivated by greed. You'll almost always make a mistake if you're motivated by just one or the other. He's advocating that you need to balance your investment. Which way? A little bit of fear, a little bit of greed. How does it balance out?
And that's why these people who recommend only 5, 10% in gold are wrong, because you're not balancing your investment. You're not balancing your risk.
Let's take a break for a couple more commercials. Melody and I will be right back on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again tonight? Each and every
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of at its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. Here's an article from Cointelegraph talking about Ethereum, which is one of the cryptocurrencies, if I understand correctly. It's tangled up. It's similar to Bitcoin. And the headline is Ethereum blockchain bloat could reach 1 terabyte in 2017. Now, Melody, would you like to explain to people what blockchain bloat is all about?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, I don't.
They invented Bitcoin. They invented blockchain at the same time. Bitcoin is a kind of digital currency, or at least it appears to be. Blockchain is a technology where you can track things. They have a ledger that's not, it's not a specific, it's a decentralized ledger that's in theory all over the internet, and it can track transactions and monitor and say, okay, it's a brilliant kind of technology, and it's being used by more people all the time. Most of us don't understand it. That includes me. But nevertheless, we all have an idea that, oh my gosh, something big is going on in the cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin's up over $3,000, or was just recently. I don't know what it is as we speak. But nevertheless, spectacularly lucrative. Right? The sort of thing where people are just getting, the temptation to get into Bitcoin is enormous. Well, here's Ethereum, which is a competitor. And it says Ethereum's blockchain, and that is this decentralized ledger, and it keeps track of every transaction. If we're dealing with Ethereum, for example, or say Bitcoin, there is a decentralized ledger where if I sell a Bitcoin to Melody, there's a record of it. And if Melody sells it to Marge, there's a record of it. And Marge sells it to Sam, there's a record of it. And there is a chain of every single transaction that's made with this Bitcoin. And you can track it backwards, and you can find out, oh, yeah, who did I sell to? Who did I receive this from? Right? And based on this decentralized ledger that can't be easily falsified, people are saying this is an effective system for currency. Right? In theory, it eliminates fraud. In fact, it does not. People are stealing the stuff on a fairly regular basis. But here's I am critical of blockchain. Well, no, I'm not critical of blockchain. I'm critical of Bitcoin. Right, I'm critical of the alternative, these cryptocurrencies. I think they're overblown, and they may go on. Some people think they're going to go just tens of thousands of dollars, for example, for an individual Bitcoin that was selling for fractions of a penny. back a few years ago, and now it's going for $3,000, and some people say it'll go for $10,000, and some people say it'll go for $1 million. I don't believe that. I don't believe it's going to $1 million. I think that's nonsense, but it's hard to get away from these. The success is hard to see and not be tempted to buy. But here's my point about Ethereum. Blockchain is now larger than Bitcoin's at around 180 gigabytes, with experts warning that further increases may spell disaster. One user, this is an Ethereum user, reported downloading the backlog of transactions for over a week while syncing a node. Melody, would you explain to him what syncing a node means?
I'll let you do that.
I don't know either. What I do understand is they apparently, it sounds like the transactions on Ethereum had become so extensive that it took a week to download a copy of this decentralized ledger. Now, I'm not sure that's what it meant, but anything on the internet that takes a week, right? I don't care what it is. I don't care what syncing a node means.
Crashing,
we are used
computer
to things moving right now on the internet. Bang, bang, bang. It happens right now. A week is unacceptable. It's intolerable. But that's what it took for one of these guys using Ethereum lately. And they call this blockchain bloat apparent. And it appears that blockchain bloat is when your decentralized ledger, your copy gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it records my, when I bought my Bitcoin and I sold it to Melody and she sold it to Marge and she sold it to Sam, and it goes on and on and on and on. And eventually the list of transactions becomes enormous and apparently gets to 180 gigabytes, and it takes time, big time, for these programs to download and be useful. Encouraging fast sync undermines decentralization, so that solution is likely inadequate. So they can't get away from this. That's part of the point. And they go on with the article, but it says, here's the punchline to me. Ethereum prices, meanwhile, hit new highs over the weekend, capping a 3,000% increase since the start of the year, which is doing the rounds across mainstream media. Ethereum, at least in some instances, has caused people to spend a week downloading something over the internet. All right? If it takes minutes, it's a long time typically. It's take a week. And nevertheless, the price is hits new highs. For me, this is evidence that this cryptocurrency has just become irrational. Why do we buy Bitcoin? And we buy it because somebody else bought it. And why did they buy it? Because somebody else bought it before they did. And why are they going to buy more? Because we bought it. And this whole thing is based on, I'm buying it because somebody else bought it, because somebody else bought it, because somebody else bought it. And as long as we keep on selling this Bitcoin, the price goes up without anything to support it other than the tendency of consumers to buy more Bitcoin. We've used the analogy before. Ford Motor Company, imagine they come up with a new carburetor, a new fuel injection system, whatever, where they can get 100 miles per gallon on, who knows, Ford Escort in downtown driving. All right? Well, that gives us reason to go out and buy Ford stock, because Ford stock is going to go up. They're going to sell more Fords. This is a great technological advance. They're going to sell more Fords. They'll get 100 miles per gallon in city driving, and everybody's going to want it. So the price, that makes sense that the price of Ford stock goes up because they have made a technological advancement. All right? Or in other industries, it could be that they found a new oil well or a new gold field. And they have more resources to exploit. All right, okay, they got more resources. The price of their stock should go up. This makes a certain amount of sense. But there is no product. There is no service that's obviously associated with Bitcoin other than the ability to pay for things without being easily tracked by the government. Doesn't mean you can't be tracked, but not easily. I don't think that's enough to justify seeing these bitcoins rise in value from fractions of a penny on up to $3,000 currently, and who knows how high they're going to go altogether. What is the reason? There is no tangible value here. And what it reminds me of, again, is the tulip mania in 16th, 17th century Holland. People are going to spend fortunes on tulips. This is not far removed from that mania. Right? There is no fundamental reality. And we see this thing is with Ethereum. It takes a week, at least in some peculiar instances, to download whatever they're doing for syncing a node, whatever that is. I don't care what it is. It takes a week, there's something wrong. It says this is going to go, this isn't going to last. This can't continue to work. And not as is. They've got to change things where it can't take a week to download. And yet, prices hit new highs over the weekend, which to my mind is evidence of Shakespeare's observation, what fools these mortals be. They're getting nothing. This is just happening because it's happening because it's happening. But there is no fundamental technology. And all of the blockchain and the Bitcoin were released as open source software back in 2009 by the investor, by the inventor, Satoshi Nakamoto.
He's not even the inventor. Oh, they don't even know who the inventor is. And I'll
you know why that is, Melody?
It's the government.
Do you know why they don't know who the inventor is?
Why, Al?
Well, nobody knows. I don't know for an absolute fact. But
yeah,
you know what I think
it is? The only way no one would know is...
He knows this thing's going to blow up. And when it does, there are going to be people that are going to be screaming. They're going to say, I paid $3,000 for a Bitcoin, and now you're telling me it's worth $50? Are you crazy? They're going to be ready to march. They're going to be ready. And if they can catch the guy that invented Bitcoin, they're going to hang him. Understand?
I think
the guy inventors understood this thing's going to blow up. And when it does, I don't even want people to know my name. You know?
I personally believe this was created by governments, the central banks. It's a great way to money launder. It's a great way to for the CIA to go in there and pay off, you know, billions of dollars. It's a great way to share funds. I think they were created by governments for the central banks and government money law.
No, I don't know who created them, but when it blows up, I think there are going to be people. Oh, I didn't, not me. I didn't create it. I didn't even recommend it. I never even recommended it. Everyone will be against it when it finally
blows
up.
And we all know that governments, governments like to use gullible citizens for their little guinea pigs. And that's exactly what is happening. People will think that, oh, Melody, you've lost your mind. No, I haven't. Until someone can actually tell me who created it and there's credible confirmation and so forth, we all can have our own belief on who created it. But I'll tell you what, who created the internet? Not Al Gore.
Al Gore. Well, that's what he said. You know, it is kind of interesting, though. There is virtually no secrecy.
It was government.
Oh, yeah, I understand.
That's what creates these programs. You know, you wonder how some of these things. Yeah. I mean,
there's supposedly no secrecy on the internet.
If you
finding the identity of whoever created blockchain and Bitcoin is probably one of it's like
probably
finding the Holy Grail. Somebody should know who this guy is.
CIA.
Well, I don't know who it is. I don't know who it is. But somebody, it is strange that no one's been able to find this out. Again, product
maybe
was released in 2009.
Could be Russia.
Nobody knows who
could
did
be
this.
Russia. Could be Russia.
I don't know. I have no idea. It wasn't me, Melody. I promise you, it wasn't me.
It's nothing. Al and I were talking during the break. It's like, yeah, I'm going to sell gold and send you digital pictures of what you're buying.
All right.
And I'm
going
to.
That's what people are buying. That's what they're essentially doing right now.
And I'm going to pretend I have all the pictures that I send you. I'm going to pretend that I have all that gold.
You know, one of the things we talk about on the program on a fairly regular basis, we touch on the difference between a payment and a promise to pay. All right. Which would you rather have? Would you rather be paid, or would you rather have a promise that you will be paid someday in the future? And the simple truth is, look, if you got a brain in your head, I want the payment. I don't want the promise to pay. I want the payment. All of our paper debt instruments, the paper dollars, the digital dollars, the stocks, the bonds, the pension funds, bank accounts, all of these, you got a little bank book, got a little, you got a list of your, what your pension, what you're entitled to in your pension was. These are all promises to pay. If it's paper or digital, it's a promise to pay. It's not a payment. A payment is something tangible that goes in your hand. It could be a piece of, it could be a gold coin, it could be a silver coin, it could be a new TV, it could be a new house, it could be a piece of land, but it's something tangible you have. Now you've been paid. While you have paper, you merely have a promise to be paid. Well, we're recommending that you stay, be wary of the promises, because there's too many
of those promises.
It's another name for debt. That's all debt is a promise to pay. We're telling people, stay away from that. Get a payment. Well, what is Bitcoin? Is it a payment, or is it a promise to pay? And the answer is, it's a promise to pay. The idea that Bitcoin is worth $3,000 right now is based on the idea that I could take that Bitcoin someday, if I owned one, I could take it and I could buy $3,000 worth of stuff and then I'd be paid. But until I get something tangible in my hand, I have not been paid. I only have a promise to pay, and that's what Bitcoin is, promise to pay. We live in times when the promises to pay can't all be kept. Debts can't all be paid. That means it's dangerous to invest your wealth in mere promises to pay. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, with Greg Hunter, incidentally. In the meantime, with the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Todd, the producer. Bye-bye.
Night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.